Again, and for the record, my name is Charles Lane. I've been conducting this week's session on our living Earth. And discussion has basically centered on the history of our awareness on the whole problem of global warming. And we're going to finish it this evening in our culminating session, which I've entitled The Third Millennium, which is actually a title out of a chapter of one of the chapters of Jonathan Weiner's book, The Next 100 Years, of which there are still a couple of copies left over in the bookstore. Chuck didn't buy them all out. And can be had for a fairly reasonable price of, what, 11, 12 bucks, something like that, 10?
$12.95.
$12.95, something about like that. Fairly reasonable price of $12.95. I'd like to take just a couple moments and recap the week, and then, in essence, recap it again during the course of the evening this evening. We've had several different types of discussions, and all of them hopefully interdependent and interrelated in keeping with the theme of the week. The very first session was one that was entitled The Seven Spheres, and it had to do with the fact that it was important for us to think about living on a sphere and identifying all the different attributes of the globe in terms of spheres. And if you think about this, you've done this all of your life in terms of talking about atmosphere, for example. We all talk about the atmosphere, but you can extend that to such things as the lithosphere, which is the crust of the Earth, the layer of rock, the hydrosphere, which are the Earth's waters. We also talk a great deal, and I have this week, about the cryosphere, the world's ice, and why that is so crucially important to our understanding of global climatic history. And so we started off with a discussion on the seven spheres. The second discussion was entitled Earth Circles, in which we were talking about how circular things tend to happen on a sphere. And we talked about how the heat energy that's generated principally at the equator migrates to the poles, does not do so in a straight line, can't when it's on a spinning sphere, can't do it. It must circle around. And again, this is experiential for every one of you because you see it every night on the weather station. You're looking at the weather station and the guy says, put the map in motion, the weather person does that, and things are spinning around. That's a function of living on a spinning sphere. That's why that happens. And one of the points we were making is that things that happen in certain parts of the world have effects in other places. What is now known as the Arctic smog, believe it or not, that's not confined just to the Bay Area or to LA anymore. There is a phenomenon known as Arctic smog. And believe it or not, there are scientists who have analyzed it and made a determination that it's been exported to the North Pole, principally from the major industrial areas of Europe. Just like chlorofluorocarbons are in the stratosphere above the South Pole. We don't manufacture chlorofluorocarbons at the South Pole. Just as there is lead in the Antarctic polar ice cap. We don't make lead in the South Pole. We make it up here in the Northern Hemisphere, in the industrialized Northern Hemisphere. So things circle across the globe in a much more profound way than perhaps what we normally think about. Third thing we talked about was Earth cycles and the fact that things cycle around. And this happens in a host of settings, and the example I used was that of the hydrologic cycle. Water evaporates off the ocean, forms clouds. In the case of the Pacific Northwest, it butts up against the Cascades and normally provides all the water that Seattle, Tacoma needs, right? Normally. It has not been a good spring in that respect. The water runs back down the mountains, back to the ocean, and it cycles. And there are lots and lots and lots of cycles. Yesterday, I talked about what may be the most important cycle there is with respect to this planet. And that is the carbon cycle, because carbon is the thing that combines with oxygen in the world's atmospheres to produce carbon dioxide, which is the principal greenhouse gas, the thing that helps warm the atmosphere by retaining heat energy and keeping it close to the Earth. And carbon cycles, we contain it in our bodies. These wonderful pine forests out here contain carbon. There is carbon contained in the ground below us, both in the soil and in limestone rocks as calcium carbonate, which is CO3. And there's a certain amount of it contained in the world's oceans as well, both as dissolved CO2, carbon dioxide, and carbonate, CO3. A great many of the invertebrate life forms on the planet, in fact, live in the ocean, and their shells are made up of calcium carbonate. Last night, or yesterday afternoon, I guess it was 6:45 session last night, talking about how this is the single most important cycle on the face of the planet with respect to its long-term consequences for the health and well-being of the entire planet. I put this up last night, but I will put it again for you to look at. One of the arguments that some of the scientific community had about global warming and carbon dioxide levels rising in the atmosphere in recent years is that the only evidence you have is the evidence from recent years. We started measuring global carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere only in about 1958. So 1958 to the present isn't but a 30-some-odd year record, not very long in the sphere of human affairs, let alone the history of the globe. What did it mean that carbon dioxide levels were rising? Last night I also made the point that the cryosphere, the sphere of ice, especially those great glaciers and ice caps that cap Antarctica and Greenland, were vitally important to us and to our well-being in a most fantastic way, because those great ice caps are a record. They are record keepers for us of a great deal of the Earth's history, at least with respect to human affairs, because the ice caps in the ice is contained a record of volcanoes blowing up in prehistoric times, of sun radiant energy waxing and waning in prehistoric times, of atmospheric temperatures going up and down and changing in prehistoric times, and also the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in prehistoric times. Antarctica gave us the ice, which gave us the record that takes us back 160,000 years in time. That is what Antarctica has given us. A treasure of information from the coldest, most remote place on Earth. But that record has told us some things that perhaps we ought to pay a little bit of attention to. This is not any kind of linear scale. This is very diagrammatic, but 160,000 years before present is the start. 1750 AD, or if you prefer, 142 years before the present. And 1958 I have marked on here as well as the present. And the thing that I'm going to point out to you is that CO2, which I've shown on this axis, is increasing upward this way. Over the past 160,000 years, has stayed within a window or stayed within a range. It has never dropped below 170 parts per million in the Earth's atmosphere, nor has it ever gone above 270 parts per million. These are average values, okay? But those are fairly close to the mark. 170 on the low end, 270 on the top end, once, twice, three, four times or so over that 160,000. The carbon dioxide levels have gone down very low to 170 parts per million. Those correspond to the last four glacial epochs in North America. There are more, but the last four glacial ice advances in North America are represented by the four low on the orange, the low troughs. And that is as low as the atmospheric carbon dioxide has gotten in the past 160,000 years. In between our times, geologists refer to the peaks as altothermals, climatologists do as well, high in temperature. And those high temperatures have not gone above about 270 parts per million. In 1750, with the Industrial Revolution going full tilt, and with copious consumption of both wood and coal, we slipped out of the window. We slipped above the 270 parts per million. And by 1958, we had moved to about 315 parts per million. And in 1958 to the present, the curve climbed up dramatically to where it stands now at somewhere just over 350 parts per million. The point is that we are way out of the window. We are a very long ways out of the window and getting farther out of it all the time. This is why earth scientists and atmospheric scientists are extraordinarily concerned about the prospects of global warming. It's that we are out of the window and we are trotting on unfamiliar territory. We don't know what is going to happen. That, I would suggest, should be a certain amount of concern just in and of itself. All right, Chuck.
What's caused the previous reversals of the going up?
What?
What's caused the reversals from these alto thermals at the time?
Lost in the mists of antiquity, actually, the cause and effect nature of the reversals, not particularly well known, although, if you're a climatologist and you're working on one of the things that might be a cause for the ice age, you'll enjoy this because you're mathematically inclined. One of the things that appears to fit very well is something that's referred to as the Milankovitch cycle. Never messed with any of that. Milut Milankovitch was he Czech or Yugoslavian? What was he, Rick?
Eastern.
Take the easy road
out.
I think he may have been Czech. But he worked with a phenomenon that, again, all of you know. You all know this phenomenon. You just have never put it in quite the terms that a scientist would. Instead of thinking of this as the globe, think of it as a child's top. You know, one of those tops that you push down on the plunger and you get the thing to spin? Okay? The top is spinning round and round and round and round. And right after you really crank this thing up, the thing is spinning like mad. And better than that, it is rock steady, right? It's spinning on the bottom, down here on the bottom point. You can remember this when you're a kid playing with the top too, because you know what happens once the top starts to slow down, right? What happens to it? It wobbles. The axis of the top starts to wobble. That, to an earth scientist or to an astronomer, is a second order motion of the earth's rotation, is that there is a wobble, and it's called precession. Astronomers have a name for it. What happens right before the top craters? What happens to the wobble?
It gets bigger and bigger.
Well, it gets more and more erratic, as a matter of fact. Wind your top up again when you get back to your room tonight. I'm sure you have one there with you. But not only does the Earth's axis wobble, but as it wobbles, there is a third order motion that is called nutation, where the thing kind of jerks as it wobbles. You can see all three of them when you play with the top. You can see all three of them. Just let the top wind down far enough, you can see it. Earth does this. And Milankovitch, in a sense, quantified this. And his premise is that as the Earth goes around the Sun and the thing wobbles and nutates, is that there are cycles in which as the Earth goes around the Sun, that the northern hemisphere, in essence, stays tilted away from the Sun. Stays tilted way away from the Sun, then wobbles kind of back this way as it comes around on this side of the Sun. And the result is that the northern hemisphere got less and less solar energy, even than normal. And that would be the master switch in that case for kicking it around. So, I mean, your question's a very good one, and there is not a good answer for it.
Has the southern hemisphere had the same kind of glacial work that the northern has, or have the oceans tempered it enough to...
The southern hemisphere, there are some ancient glaciations in Australia, southern Australia, and southern Africa, and also in India. There is some evidence of glaciation in the southern hemisphere, but much older geologically speaking, and where the those places would have been in terms of plate tectonics and position on the globe is a little different. Southern hemisphere is much more moderate climate all the way around because there's so much more water. So, actually, this kind of takes us through the week. Made it through all the rest of the four lectures in, what, 15 minutes? Kind of on a roll there. All right. Now, if we get to this point, we can say that there's virtually no scientist or scientific body anywhere on the planet that would argue with this graph that you see behind us. Nobody's going to argue with that. The so what's and the questions that arise, you know, if you don't like this and don't like the interpretations that are being put at this, the questions tend to be one of three kinds in terms of the so what, all right? So what if this is going to happen? There will be some type of negative feedback loop that is going to change this and bring it back down. We just don't know what it is yet. That's one of the so what's that's asked. One of the things I talked about a couple of times back was positive and negative feedback loops. Warming tends to be gap warming. The warmer it gets, the more the ocean evaporates, the more it evaporates, the more water vapor gets in the air, which is a greenhouse gas, the warmer the atmosphere gets. That's a positive feedback loop. Negative feedback loop is kind of what you do when you set the thermostat in the winter. You know, you come in the house, you've been out all day, and the thing's down to 40 degrees, and you want it to go to 60, you kick the thermostat up, and it rock and rolls for a while, and then shuts itself off, and you get the desired temperature. That would be like a negative feedback loop. So there are certain people who would say, there's a negative feedback loop out there someplace, and it's going to kick in and bring this CO2 level and this warming level back down. We just don't know what it is yet. How comfortable does that make you feel? That's one of the things. Another one of the things is that we don't yet have enough data, and we need to watch this a little longer, and if the problem becomes acute, then we'll deal with it. We'll adapt to it at that point in time. Terribly human response. It's the George Bush response, right? We don't have anywhere near enough data yet, so let's not monkey with it. And when it gets to be an acute problem, let's deal with it. And that's a human condition, right? We're very much into dealing with acute situations, and we're not all that much into chronic situations. Shall we work the thing with the frog now again? Make you happy? It's the old biology professors. You never did this because you're too kind to animals. But it's the old biology professors thing about heating a beaker full of water to boiling and then throwing a frog in, and the frog jumps right back out again. I had a friend who actually did that with a crab. She bought a live crab. Yeah,
that's what you do with it.
That's how you cook them, right? She bought this live crab, and she threw it in the pot, but she forgot to put the lid on. The crab came back out after chasing her around the kitchen. So I would have liked to have seen that. Actually, she was telling the story. It's been funny to watch.
I wouldn't.
But what you do instead is you put the frog in a nice cool beaker of water, and then you gradually warm it up. And the frog will boil to death. You know, acute things we respond to, chronic things we don't. Now, the problem with that is, you know, when's acute, how acute, and one of the problems with this curve up here is that we have no idea. We have absolutely none whatsoever. When push comes to shove, we have no idea at what CO2 level in the atmosphere you actually roll past the point of no return. You roll past a runaway greenhouse effect like you have on the Venetian surface, where there is nothing you can do to stop it. We just do not know. Okay. The third thing that comes up in terms of a rebuttal is, well, what if the temperature only goes up a few degrees? I mean, what are we talking? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 degrees at most centigrade, maybe 10 degrees Fahrenheit or so, is what the global climatic modelers predict. So what? You know, I've been out when it's 90, I've been out when it's 100, so what? Okay. In fact, the Ehrlichs, Ehrlich's in their book, Healing the Planet, which also is over in the bookstore, by the way. This is the plug for the Ehrlich book. Healing the Planet, the Ehrlich's address that very thing. This is the section on Should We Care? Let me read just a part of it. So what? Why should society care if the planet gets a little warmer? If a 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in average global temperature over the past century has occurred, which, by the way, is pretty much the consensus in the climatic modeling community. There's been a 1 degree Fahrenheit increase. It's scarcely been noticed. Even the 3 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit warming that models indicate over the next half century don't seem so awful. Sure, Dallas might get hotter than hell, but Minneapolis, Fairbanks, and Moscow might have livable winters. In this vein, we heard Michael Boskin, the chief economic advisor to President Bush, poo-poo the whole idea of global warming. At a meeting of business executives in Virginia, he pointed out that virtually all who were there had experienced temperature changes of more than a few degrees as they traveled to the meeting and were none the worse for it. And all we can do is model what a 7 or 9 degree rise in Fahrenheit temperature would do, because we have never, as a species, experienced anything warmer than what we've experienced right now. We are living right now at the warmest time this planet has experienced in the past 160,000 years. I say as species in terms of keeping track of what we're doing anyway. We don't know. But we do know from the record in the ice and in the geologic record, we do know what 7 to 9 degrees lower will do. 7 to 9 degrees lower will result in a piece of ice that is basically 4,000 to 5,000 feet thick parked on the doorstep of Lawrence, Kansas. 7 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit lower will allow you to walk from Great Britain to France or from Siberia to the United States, because 7 to 9 degrees lower is the coldest it got compared to our temperatures now on a global average in the last ice age. That's the difference between right now and the last global ice age for average global temperature. And we've been 10,000 years recovering from that. Question?
I assume they've also kept records of the average temperature over the years. How does it correlate with the CO2 content? Any correlation?
As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting to bring that up. This CO2 axis over here, if I do my scaling correctly, I could just as easily put temperature on that.
Thanks.
We've been 10,000 years recovering from temperature that was 9 degrees less than it is now. University of Kansas sits on Mount Oread in Lawrence, Kansas, because that's where the glacier pushed the last bunch of dirt. That's why it exists there. The Siberian land bridge is what allowed all of those Central Asian peoples to migrate into North America. 7 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit lower is all. We've been 10,000 years recovering from that, and we're in the process of modeling, predicting that much warming in the next half of a century, the next 50 years.
I think that we've got to, anything else for a press on? Made enough of a point there.
I think we've got to think about, we don't have to think about catastrophic change. We don't have to think about a runaway greenhouse effect. We can think for a long time on what a 2 or 3 or 4 degree Fahrenheit warming might do. Because the warming will affect the climate, will affect the ecosystems, which, by the way, affects the biodiversity. Bring in some other diversity. Which affects us. very dramatic fashion. Think about a sec. Here's a couple of tidbits that come out of the Ehrlich book on this. Our global satellite systems, our Landsat satellites flying over the United States, can do some fairly amazing things. One of the things they can do is they can make determinations of soil moisture. This is actually more Rick's thing than mine, but you can talk to him and I'm sure he'll give you something of the same story. If not, I'll pay him off to make sure he does. But the global satellites can track soil moisture in America's breadbasket. They've been tracking soil moisture. And it's less. You get less soil moisture in America's breadbasket, you're going to have a profound effect on what you grow there. If you have global warming and you shift climatic zones and make Minneapolis and Duluth, right?
There you are.
Duluth. All of Saskatchewan and Manitoba, a better place for growing crops. You're still going to be chasing that climatic zone north. How would you like to be planting wheat one winter here and the next winter, I say winters, maybe over a period of years, you may be changing this north. And you get to the boreal forests of northern Canada, and that now becomes the world's breadbasket. Problem is those soils are not breadbasket soils. Those soils are good for pine trees. They're not breadbasket soils. Even with the climate changing, there's a lag before the soil development occurs. It's going to allow it to be a breadbasket. You know, we're kind of on the edge already in terms of feeding the world's population.
So what happens to Kansas then? Does that become a desert?
Yeah. And there is certain precedent for that because you can go into some of the bare rock country of the Sahara, into some of the caves in there, and you can find the cave pictographs of the indigenous peoples herding cattle in what is now the heart of the Sahara. There has been climatic shifts in the past as well. So at any rate, you're going to shift your soil development farther and farther north. You are going to deprive the breadbasket of soil moisture. You lose your winter, and Duluth will have the same problems that we now have in Texas, a real lack of natural pest control. One of the really nasty things about living that far south is you don't have winters, you don't kill bugs. Devastate crops as a result of that. Make it big.
Bug.
Your ecosystems, you know, how fast do trees run? You know, if you're moving, shifting climatic belts, how fast do trees run? Your trees run fast enough.
I've seen one run.
Maybe the human endeavor would help. Maybe you could take tree seeds and move them farther north. But the trees are going to have a hard time running. The world's great coral reef factories in the Bahamas are dying off right now because the surficial water temperatures are too high because the coral is very sensitive to the temperature ranges and the water temperature. Those things are dying off. Leads you into the whole question of biodiversity, extinction of species. Some other things that perhaps not so agriculturally and biodiversity kind of related things, but the global modeling predictions for this 3 to 4 degree Fahrenheit temperature rise also would give you a 1 foot sea level rise. And you say, 1 foot sea level rise. And that happens in a couple of ways. The first one you can kind of think about is that the ice caps melt somewhat. You get sea level rise, but you also need to realize that as water heats up, it expands. Okay, heats up, it expands. You get 1 foot sea level rise. So what? So what if you're on the coast of California and you're at Big Sur and you're standing up here at the top? You've had a day off from Stanford. You were so sleepy and so tired in class that you just couldn't stay awake. So you had to go out and stand at the edge of Big Sur, you know, get a sea breeze, wake yourself up. She didn't want to go to class that day anyway. You're standing there, and the mean sea level is this high, and you have a 1 foot sea level rise to this point. No big deal. On the other hand, if you live in Bangladesh, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people that live on land that is no higher than 1 foot above sea level, and this is the original mean sea level, and this is a 1 foot rise, then 1 foot sea level rise is a fantastic thing. The other thing as well is that when you get bad weather, storm surges, and when you get storm surges, you don't want them to happen at high tide, right? Any of those of you who live in low-lying areas or ever lived in the coastal Gulf area of the United States, those people pay attention as to whether or not the storm surges are coming at a high tide stage or the low tide stage. They really do. A low tide stage, they much prefer to a high tide stage. Because if you have that storm surge when the water's already up, then the destructive capability is much greater. And the same thing happens if you have a sea level rise of a foot, because the storm surge is going to be just that much worse. All of those great deltas of the world on which there is so much agricultural production, the Mississippi Delta, Nile Delta, okay, the Brahmaputra, Ganges Delta, not only is a storm surge and 1 foot sea level rise in and of itself destructive, but that kind of water level rise will lead to the salinification of the groundwater aquifers. It'll push the fresh water back, and you'll make them salty with a 1 foot sea level rise. Think of how many of the world's peoples live at low elevations on places like that, places like that. The effects would be disastrous from a 1 foot sea level rise. A 9 degree Fahrenheit temperature drop in the last ice age, 250 to 300 foot sea level drop. We go out in submarines and go off the, somebody pointed this out last time I brought it up, you go off the east coast of New Jersey, and you go several hundred miles out on the continental shelf, and you actually take photographs of like mastodon footprints.
Is that right?
Yeah, that are now under a couple hundred feet of water. Of course, what was pointed out to me is that if you go offshore New Jersey, you're likely to find anything. So that may not mean all that. But a 9 degree temperature drop gave us that much of a drop in sea level. So we may be awfully conservative thinking about the 1 foot sea level rise. The other thing I pointed out that happens when you have very warm water has to do with the business of hurricanes. And those of you who are West Coast types know that you don't often get hurricanes up and down the California coast. You do get some kind of funky monsoonal weather in southern Arizona that comes up from the Gulf of California, which is a backwater and fairly warm. The water's too cold. You got to get to that 80 degree Fahrenheit range before it's a switch, flipping on the light. That's hurricane season. The water's got to be that warm. Big hurricanes, big winds, come waltzing on shore. They don't die off till they get on shore. They gotta have water. They gotta have warm water to survive. Really, really big hurricanes, by and large, don't come on shore because they are so strong that not only do they suck up all the warm water at the surface of the ocean, they suck up colder water that's below and kill them while they're still out over the open ocean. What's going to happen if you warm the world's oceans some?
Hurricanes. They won't die so quickly.
You'll see bigger and nastier hurricanes, yeah. They won't die so quickly. And again, those of you who live in the Gulf Coast area of the United States, this isn't a matter of academic interest by any means. Now, this is a day-to-day kind of thing. California depends not so much on rainfall. Southern California doesn't depend so much on rainfall as it does upon snowfall. If you have global warming, you may have places that have a lot of rain, but you tend to have less snow in the temperate regions. California, the way it's set up now, does not need a lot more rain in April and May. They need a lot more snow in the winter, so they have it late in the summer when the drought season really sets in. I mean, we'd go on all night with this. I throw out just example after example after example. The point that I'm trying to make here is that we don't have to think about some kind of catastrophic runaway greenhouse effect to realize that there is an enormous potential for trouble with just changing temperature of a very few degrees. There's an enormous potential for devastation around the globe. The Tom Wolfe quote up here. There's no law of history that says a new century must start 10 or 20 years beforehand, but it has worked out that way. That's in his eulogy for the 20th century. It's also the start of chapter 6 in his book, also entitled The First Summer of the Third Millennium. Again, I haven't done this in any other sessions, but I thought I'd read to you a little bit out of the book for just a moment and let you start thinking yourself about some things. Sunday, July 10th, 1988. Weather station in the castle in Central Park. The high for the day was 99 degrees Fahrenheit. Relative humidity was 93% at 1 o'clock in the morning. It had been one of the hottest weeks in living memories. Cab drivers could actually feel their tires sinking into the asphalt in the middle of Fifth Avenue. Air conditioners were breaking down all over town, and Ira Parker, the air conditioner salesman at Uncle Steve's electronics store, would soon be laughing in customers' faces. "I've sold demos," he said. "I've sold displays. I've even sold the pictures." No relief at the beach. The shores of Long Island and New Jersey were fouled by a backwash of New York City's raw sewage and trash. Children playing along the tide line found used hospital blood bags, latex gloves, and syringes contaminated with the AIDS virus. For city police and criminologists, the number of consecutive 90-plus days is a predictor of urban violent crime. That week, Wednesday had been 92, Thursday 93, Friday 97, Saturday 88. And that weekend in the five boroughs, more than three dozen people were shot, stabbed, beaten, or strangled to death. In the South, the heat was stunting the corn. In the Midwest, drought was killing wheat, corn, sorghum, soybeans. And it was clear that the summer would be the worst since the Dust Bowl. Some small towns in Iowa folded in the summer of 88. In the West and across the country, more than 6 million acres burned, the worst forest fires in recorded history. All but 5% of the big rivers in the U.S. were running low. Mississippi dropped so low that it stranded thousands of barges and exposed old shipwrecks, paddle-wheelers from the Gilded Age. Wheat died in Canada and the Soviet Union. Rice died in the People's Republic of China. China lost more than 10,000 people and 500,000 houses in droughts, floods, typhoons, and freak hailstorms. Shanghai in July was even worse than New York City, more than 1 million people sick from the heat. In the Yucatan, whole villages and beaches were swept into the sea by Hurricane Gilbert, the most powerful storm of the century. Torrential rains and flash floods in India, Nigeria, Gambia, Mali, on and on and on. In Bangladesh, floods put more than 3/4 of the country underwater. Drought was particularly bad in North America. It was worse since the 30s. As in the Dust Bowl days in Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, Kansas, Texas, farmers stared at the dark cloud on the horizon, which was their topsoil blowing away. 12 million acres damaged by wind erosion as of June 1st. Prize heifers and pregnant cows sold for slaughter because there was too little grass to feed them. By the first week in July, the Midwest was so hot and dry that when a few drops fell in Kansas City, Missouri during the ninth inning of a close game, the Kansas City Royals trailing the Chicago White Sox, the 23,000 fans in the stadium did not boo the rain. They stood up and cheered. There is a parenthetical note to this as well. The heat made even baseball more dangerous that summer. A study by psychologists at the University of Michigan shows that when the temperature in the stadium rises over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, more pitchers bean batters. President Reagan photographed an Illinois cornfield in the middle of the Big Dry. The corn, which should have been over his head, was waist high. People knew they were participating in historic misery. In Custer County, Montana, John L. Moore took his two young children to Hilltop and pointed to three range fires spilling black smoke from the Badlands. Remember this day, Moore told them, this is something you will someday tell your children about. But August was the cruelest month in the summer of 88. Here you go, Minnesota. The National Weather Service monthly summary in Minneapolis. Excessive heat continued. The high of 92 on the 3rd marked the 37th time this year the daily high reached 90 degrees or above. This is Minneapolis, Minnesota, folks, breaking the 1936 record. Warmest summer period ever recorded. New record high temperatures set in August. 101 on the 1st, 99 on the 2nd, 99 on the 16th. Detroit factories shut down. Harvard University canceled summer classes. In New York City, which had 32 days above 90 by the middle of August, 200 people were murdered, a 75% jump from the same month the year before. Americans spent an extra $500 million in August running Freon cooled air conditioners. Reagan signed a $3.9 billion farm relief bill commending farmers' indomitable spirit. North American Seed Division of Pioneer Hybrid International, Inc., the biggest seed company in the world, was scrambling to plant new fields of seed corn, many in South America, which was having a great year, to make up for the lost corn in time for next year's crop. At the Illinois State Fair in Springfield, Joe Beal, 4-H judge, awarded blue ribbons to children's best tomatoes, cabbage, carrots, and eggplants. In a normal year, he told a reporter out of earshot of children, these would not have been brought in. Jonathan Weiner has noted that the 1980s were the hottest decade in recorded history of human race. 1988 was barely worse than 1987, and 1990 is the hottest single year ever recorded in the human race. In 1988, during the fall, a number of folks got together in Washington to discuss whether or not the greenhouse effect had started. And the answer was, and still is, we don't really know for sure that the greenhouse effect has really started. But what we do know for very sure is that the summer of 88 was very unpleasant. At the end of this chapter, two things. First, climate expert Stephen Schneider. The most perversive impact of global temperature change will be to increase the chances of certain kinds of extreme events. Not frosts, obviously, but heat waves and droughts. We humans, as biological systems, do not feel climate shifts through slow changes. What we feel is extreme events. What slow changes really mean to us is that they'll increase the probability of extreme events. People say, my God, what happened? Not the 1 degree. It's the 1 degree that makes these outline 1 in 100 year events become 1 in 25 year events, and makes the 1 in 25 year events become the 1 in 5 year events. Close of the chapter. Richard Houghton, who is at Woods Hole Research Center, says, with respect to global warming, the right question isn't, was 88 the start? The real question is, did you like 88?
If not, what are you going to do about it?
And that's kind of where I tend to leave off with this thing. In some respects, we're in the midst of an extraordinary experiment. I know that we're out of the window. We're a long ways out of the window and heading off toward parts unknown. And we really are in the midst of an experiment, but maybe we've seen some of the effect of that. I would suggest that most all of you, if you think a little bit, and remember back to the summer of 88, where you were, because that was the Yellowstone fires, right? Mm-hmm. It was the year of the Yellowstone fires, so that's a marker for you to think about. You kind of think of where you were and some of the things that were going on. And it was not pleasant. It was a summer that we moved from California to Texas via Arizona, New Mexico, and it was not pleasant. So, my attempt in this has been to deal a little bit with consciousness raising, trying to show you the history of the concern for global warming. It's not a very long history. Its roots are back in the late 50s. It's not a long history at all. And it started with one man, in essence, Charles Keeling at Caltech, just trying to figure out how best to measure levels of carbon dioxide. And since then, we've had this real awareness. And to me, that's a very frightening aspect, is how easily all this might have gotten away from us. There are objections. Let's wait and see what happens. Let's deal with the problem that gets here. Maybe there's a problem here already, and we don't know. Is it responsible for us to sit around and not do anything else about it?
Are there other things that have been plotted on that graph, such as population, amount of fossil fuels,
sure,
being utilized, and do they sort of?
There are some interesting.
Go over the carrying capacity at the same time.
There are some interesting comparisons here. The rate of population doubling increases dramatically at about this point in time. So there's a direct correlation between the amount of population and CO2 taking off. The use of fossil fuels increases dramatically. That, of course, is a function of population, but it's also, I think, not coincident that all of the major Mideast oil fields came online after the Second World War. So our ability to utilize fossil fuels was greatly improved by access. The other things that are interesting that need to be factored in, I've mentioned on a couple of occasions that one of the greenhouse gases that is rising at the fastest rate is methane, and rising at a much faster rate than carbon dioxide, and it's a much nastier greenhouse gas. We can track methane the same way we've tracked CO2. There's kind of a baseline there that's a lot lower than what we're looking at today. And of course, the chlorofluorocarbons didn't exist until 1930. And so any levels you see there are levels we've only had for the past 60 years. And their use has grown at kind of an exponential rate since their first development.
Is it not true that you can track the carbon dioxide level so well that when the two oil embargoes, you can see a drop in the atmosphere?
You can see carbon dioxide levels with extraordinary sophistication. The Arab oil embargo is there. Yeah, it shows up. It's absolutely incredible. You can track. In fact, it's mentioned in his book that there was a drop in atmospheric CO2 right after the first major Arab oil embargo. We actually had CO2 reduction just from the embargo, which actually, in some respects, is very hopeful sign. You know,
it is. It reacts that quickly,
that well. It still would be a very long process. The Ehrlichs make the point that if all the vehicles, the automobiles in the United States were capable of about 50 miles per gallon, we still would be an energy independent country. We would not import foreign oil. And that we would cut down on CO2 levels enormously. There are, if you want to talk about strategic thinking and strategies to deal with the problem, the Ehrlich's book on healing the planet, it's more expensive. It's $22, but it's hardback. And those of you who've read the Ehrlich's, by the way, put in your pitch, kiddo, tell them who the Ehrlich's are.
He's a biologist. I didn't know she
could. She's a biologist as well. She's a research associate at Stanford.
Yeah, and they study, well, I only heard one lecture by him, but he was talking about the population growth and how it's just skyrocketed since, I think it was since 1950 or 58, or somewhere right around there.
Go ahead.
And all the, gosh, it was last fall, but.
I'm putting you on the spot again.
Yeah, but that's right
now. You've been here several times, so now you're getting used to it.
And just how, what an effect that's having, that's going to have us on us, and how soon. And he was saying, to us, he was saying, you guys have to deal with this in the next 10 years, or, those kind of doomsday stuff is a little scary.
He is the, and I'll look it up, make sure, Bing, B-I-N-G, professor of population studies at Stanford. He's been writing for a good many years. I'm sure many of you have his books. My point is that he is not as easy reading as Weiner would be, but there are strategies, and they talk about what they think are legitimately attainable CO2 reductions, the possible reductions. This is why the world was mad at us at Rio. We put out more carbon dioxide than anybody else in the world, about 25% of the world's carbon dioxide. The current figures are that every one of us in this room, or shall I say, for every one of us in this room, the United States industrial process puts out about 5 tons of carbon every year. Everybody sitting in the room. Compare that to people in Switzerland and some of the European countries where they put out about 1 ton, and compare that to undeveloped countries where there's very little now. Obviously, this is a highly industrialized country. The hopeful signs are that places like Germany and Japan, which are highly industrialized countries, are putting out about half of what we do here, meaning that Japan, for instance, gets more out of its industrial process for the energy it consumes. So there's a certain hope there. James, jump in.
Yes, Charles. I wonder if you could, some efforts you could tell us about where we're trying to bridge the environmental concern with the economic, because I'm sure if you today gave the choice in some of the lesser developed countries for an increase in the standard of living at the sacrifice of some environmental concerns, which may hurt us, may not, I'm pretty sure we know what the answer would be. And we know there are strong efforts to do just that at the expense of the environment. Are there any? Who's looking at the combined effort to sort of see where we can go to find pollution, less damaging pollution industries, if you will, and whatever?
What kinds of organizations would be involved?
Are there some organizations or some... I want to feel better leaving this room.
Than what you do right now.
Because somebody must be looking.
One of the things, and we'll jump on this, just going to be happy about it. One of the things out of the Ehrlich book, one of the things out of Senator Al Gore's book, which is also in the bookstore, I'm going out on a limb right now and tell you that if this has scared you at all, you ought to read Al Gore's book and think about supporting him in his next bid for presidency. It's my paid political announcement. I'll send Al a bill. But at any rate, if you check in this book and in Al Gore's book, the talk is about strategies, and you've got to pick your targets. Okay, you've got to pick your targets and how you're going to address them. And I'll try to put this all in nutshells as briefly as I can. There are certain types of problems you address at certain levels. And when you are starting to talk about hazardous waste issues, that's a local type of a problem that is best addressed perhaps by your direct intervention. You're being involved in some kind of local political action type thing. The regional issues, groundwater contamination of a regional aquifer, is addressed in a somewhat different fashion. That the process
is not so much local, but working through, for example, an organization that would be tied to municipal water districts, working with groundwater. But that on a global issue like this, which this is a global issue, the way the strategy for your greatest effect is actually to, other than what you try to do yourself in terms of cutting down on CO2, cutting down on the CO2 that you personally are responsible for producing, and planting more trees in your yard, right? As hokey as it sounds, planting some more trees in your yard. Your best move is to become involved and support some type of national or international organization. And since we're dealing with a serious CO2 emissions problem in the United States, a national organization that's dedicated to fighting this kind of thing might be the best place to, say, send your $25 a year sort of thing. And that would include such things as the Environmental Defense Fund, Center for Research for the Defense of the Environment. Some of that stuff is out there. Union of Concerned Scientists, that kind of thing.
Are you looking at the economic as well?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There's that aspect as well. And the Ehrlichs address that to a certain extent, too. I think you would probably enjoy that, bro. I won't keep anybody who's got to go. I will certainly stick around and field any other questions.
Have you analyzed the, as much as you can, any presidential platforms?
There are
no good ones.
Is there one?
There are no good ones.
Is there one?
I wasn't expecting one.
There are no good ones in this one, but you might think about the stuff that's in Al Gore's book. Think about.